asterisk next to that.
That is remarkable, because for me it's an 8, and we will get into that in a little bit. But once again, you have been listening to Fresh Hop Cinema, maybe on KZFR 90.1 FM. The French Dispatch is in theaters now. If you get a chance to see it, you got thoughts of your own, find us on social media at Fresh Hop Cinema, or send an email to fhccast@gmail.com.
Or head over to our website, freshhopcinema.com, for film reviews, beer reviews, and podcast episodes dating all the way back to 2016. To our KZFR listeners, if you want to hear the rest of this conversation, which includes spoilers for The French Dispatch, a second beer, and our discussion of Marvel's Eternals, plus the ever-unpredictable Hot and Bothered section, head over to your favorite podcast app and subscribe to us, Fresh Hop Cinema. To those of you already listening on the podcast app, we will be right back to talk spoilers in the Danger Zone.
Fresh Hop Cinema is made possible in part by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by the Handlebar, offering 28 taps of craft beer, German-inspired pub fare, and an outdoor patio on 20th Street in Chico next to Winco. They open every day at noon. The Handlebar, a specialty beer bar for the adventurer. Check out the Handlebar on Facebook or call 894-BEER for more information. And by Affordable Automotive, repairing and maintaining all makes of cars, trucks, and SUVs since 1996. Located at 2106 Park Avenue in Chico, Affordable Automotive has pickup and delivery service with financing available. Appointments at 892-1774 and at chicoautomotive.com. Affordable Automotive is also looking for technicians to join their team. Call Mike Button at 892-1774 for details. And hey, if you enjoyed Fresh Hop Cinema, you can now go to kzfr.org and tip this show.
Hello, it's 6 o'clock in beautiful Chico, California. This is S. Dr. Gail Kimball, and we do this show, We the Royal, We, the second Thursday of each month from 6 to 7 p.m. And tonight we're going to hear my interview with Ashanti Branch. He's a really wonderful man. He grew up poor in Oakland, African-American, wasn't encouraged to do well in school, was considered uncool. But he was really good in math and ended up at Humboldt State and went on to be an educator and to start support groups for boys of color in the Bay Area. He's a really wonderful person, and so I'm eager for you to meet him, learn from him. And all my interviews are on my YouTube channel, too. So if you want to have a visual as well as an auditory exploration, you just Google YouTube Gail Kimball and you'll find them. This interview with Ashanti Branch is part of a series that I'm doing with men for a new book. You know, I'm always writing a book. And this one may be called Men's Views of Masculinity. I'd love to hear from you about titles and your thoughts about masculinity. It's interesting because our favorite Senator Josh Hawley from, is it Missouri, is making a big campaign to prepare for running for president, where he says there's a crisis and the liberals are destroying men and, you know, eroding traditional patriarchy. So masculinity is definitely in the news. Also, PSA wanted you to know that if you know people who need free medical care, Shalom Free Clinic provides it every Sunday afternoon. You can just search Shalom Free Clinic. And there's no money that changes hands. I really love the concept. And there's a physician, Dr. Logan. Sometimes there's a psychiatrist. So there's all kinds of resources. Also food and clothes. And then every Wednesday we do energy balancing and Reiki with me and Elizabeth West. And also there's a Reiki class being taught this Saturday that's a benefit for Shalom Free Clinic. All the money goes to that. Okay, so let us start with Ashanti Branch, if I can make the screen come back. Come back, little screen. Oh, no, it went away. I think I have to jiggle the mouse. Please come back, screen. I have to log in again. Okay, so Zephyr, Zephyr, 8.1, enter. Okay, thank you for your patience. Like I say, the screen went black. I love technology. Okay, while I'm figuring this out, I'm going to read the thank yous. Ask Dr. Gale is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Friends of the Arts, your state local partner to the California Arts Council since 2001. Friends of the Arts creates economic opportunity by producing and supporting events and by publishing a bi-monthly arts and culture newsletter. To stay in the know or have your event listed, visit friendsof.art. Ask Dr. Gale is also made possible by Drunken Dumpling in Chico. First created as a food cart, Drunken Dumplings is now a dine-in restaurant serving locally sourced, fresh, handmade Asian fusion comfort food at 1414 Park Avenue, Suite 120, just behind Nobby's. It's open 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. Details are on the Facebook, Instagram pages and at drunkendumplingchico.com. Drunken Dumpling is where they love food, flavor, and our community. Ask Dr. Gale is also made possible by Grocery Outlet of Chico. Independent owner and operator Chris Hofstetler offers local and brand name groceries, housewares, health and beauty products, organic items, wines, and more. Grocery Outlet of Chico is open weekdays from 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. and at 8 p.m. on the weekend. It's located at 2157 Pillsbury Road, and you can find them on Facebook and at groceryoutlet.com. So we're going to listen to a little bit of music while I get back to the screen opening up for me.
But you ruined her in the year. Don't act like it was hard, and you swear you didn't know. No wonder why you didn't ask. She was sleeping in your clothes. But now she's got to get to class. How dare you? And how could you? Will you only feel bad when they find out if you could take it all back? Would you?
Mr. Branch, thank you very much for talking with me. Yay, I'd like to start at the very beginning, which is where and when were you born?
I was born in Oakland, California, to a single mother. And my father had, he died before I was born.
And so, your grandfather, I read, both of them.
Yeah, my grandfather, my father and my grandfather. So my father died in September of 1974, and his father died 1 week before he died. So my father had went to Little Rock, Arkansas for the funeral, and what he had planned to do was to come back to Oakland, and then he was going to pack up his barbershop, and he was going to move to Arkansas. He was trying to, you know, figure out how he was going to get away from some of the chaos in Oakland. And he came back to Oakland, and I guess in one of those last night partying, someone laced some marijuana with a drug, and his heart couldn't handle it. And instead of them taking him to the hospital, these people who were supposed to be his friends took him to my grandmother's house. Like, she was supposed to know what to do with him, and he passed before the ambulance could. I don't know if they, you know, when they finally, claimed him dead, but he died there at my grandmother's house.
What a waste. And then, so you were born in 1974?
Yes, 1974, December.
So are you a Sagittarian?
I am a Sagittarius.
That, you know, that happens a lot. I did a trilogy of visionary scientists, and Sagittarians were the most frequent type because they ask deep questions and they are willing to move forward. Do you think of yourself as adventurous and asking deep questions?
I do. And I love adventure. I love taking the young people in our program on adventures. We just created a game called The Adventure. It's called Ever Forward Club The Adventure. So, yeah, how ironic that that's the case. Because we over the last 2 years, 2019 and 2017, we took them on an outdoor adventure during the summer. So, yeah, I'm a big adventurer.
You were majored in civil engineering at Cal Poly, which is one of the best technical schools in California. And yeah. How did you get there in the face of, which I'm assuming is adversity, being raised without a lot of male role models to tell you to succeed?
Yeah. So it was kind of interesting. So when I got to Cal Poly was very, you know, not a lot of diversity. Not a lot of people who looked like me.
Oh, no.
I had, ironically, when I was in high school, I was in a program called MESA, which was Mathematics, Engineering, and Science Achievement. And there was a man who came to a camp. His name was Chris, and he was an engineering major at Cal Poly. So he would speak at this camp. And what I got to do is I got to meet him. And I didn't even know what Cal Poly was at the time, but he would come and speak at this camp. And it was amazing. And I really felt like he was a poet. He had the power of words. He knew his history. And he was like, oh, I'll go to Cal Poly. And so I heard it there. And then when I was a junior, there was two seniors in my calculus class who were on there going to Cal Poly. And I was like, well, where's Cal Poly? And I was like, wait a minute. And I started putting some dots together. And I was like, I'm going to Cal Poly. And it was like that moment where I had never been there. And there was no internet where I could look up Cal Poly on the internet and be like, let me see what the campus looks like. I had this black and white Cal Poly, you know, catalog, a bunch of pages, a couple of black and white pictures. And I was like, I'm going there. And I remember, taking a tour there. I took a tour there, and there was, like, I got off the bus. It was a rainy day. I remember getting off the bus right in front of the University Union, and I was just like, I don't even like rain. If I could despise rain, I would. I know we need rain. I know the importance of rain. But whether you ask me do I like rain or not, I'd rather be sunny, you know? So I got off the bus on a gloomy, ugly day in San Luis Obispo, and I'm like, this is where I'm going to go to school. And I hadn't even accepted yet. And literally like 3-4 weeks later after that, I got accepted. And I was like, everything else went away. It was just like Cal Poly focused. And so that's how it all happened.
So was your mom encouraging of you? Because you say in one of the videos on your site that for the boys that you taught as a math teacher, it was not cool to get A's. Why should I try? It's not considered a manly thing to do. So what? How come you didn't fall into that trap?
I think more, I'll probably describe it like this. I'll describe it like, I don't know if it was about the gender part, but it just wasn't cool. Now, if girls were getting good grades, it was cool because that's what they were supposed to do. And if you were okay being a nerd, then it was okay being smart. So, but I think it was more about the people who I hung out with and who I thought were cool. To them, smart wasn't cool. And I think, ironically, they are all boys. So it's definitely a connection in that. But it was like, you can't, when you go, who do you think you are? You think you're smarter than us? It was almost like to act smart was a threat to other young men in the circle I was in. So I was like, all right, well then I won't let them see how smart I am. I'll just pretend, right? I'll pretend not to be doing my work. Now, my report card was funny because I would do really good in math because I didn't have to try in math. Math was, like, easy for me. So people would be, like, thinking I somehow my report card was a mistake or I was cheating or something. Like, why do you have C minus, D, and then a B plus or an A? And, you know, I'm like, I don't know. Like, well, I don't care about this stuff because I didn't really care about school. Like, school was like a break from my night job. My night job was taking care of my siblings, you know? So I had to take care of them and responsible for them. So I didn't have, like, I didn't go home and be like, oh, I get to just go and work on homework and be myself. I was like, cook, clean, wash dishes, fold clothes, wash clothes, fold the dishes. What am I saying?
What? Yeah. How many sisters and how they were all younger?
Everyone was younger. I was the oldest. I had a sister who was after me, but I'm 4 years older. So, you know, until she got to the age where she could do some help with stuff too, but I was responsible for them still. It was still, you know, I had to make sure they did their work. So even if I gave them chores to do, I have to make sure, you know, if it doesn't get folded right, I got to refold it because I know my mom, her standards are like here, right? So I had a lot of responsibility. So when I went to school in middle school, I had no...
How many siblings did you have?
Well, I'm the oldest of four, so I had three. At the time I'm talking about when I was in middle school, there was only two. My mom, she got married, I think, when I was, I don't know, maybe I was 12 or 13. I think it was 12 or 13 when she got married. And then she had a son by that man. And it wasn't very pleasant. It wasn't a very pleasant experience for me. I thought I was getting a father. But anyway, I got into getting like a very mean person, you know? Like he wasn't nice. He wasn't nice to us. I mean, his son experienced a father who was loving and would take him out and take him places. We didn't get that. And I think because I had already been raising my siblings, you know, I was told by my uncle at 7 years old, Ashanti, you're the man of the house. So I knew that my role was to take care of my siblings. So I took care of them the best way I knew how as a young person trying to take care of other kids. So when he came and he treated us kind of badly, I just kept loving them and taking care of them like I was, you know, obliged to do by my uncle. And so it became a really tough situation at home, you know, because it wasn't as pleasant. And my mom kind of, I think she felt in the middle. I mean, and I had a lot of talks. We had a lot of arguments because she took his side a lot of times. I'm like, how are you going to take his side? He just showed up here. You know what I'm saying? And I think that for her, it was kind of like, you know, my grandfather was trying to help. My grandfather kind of played a mediator role sometime. He was like, well, she has to, you know, that's her husband now. So she has to. I'm like, look, I've been here since the beginning. How's she going to take his side? How's she going to believe him over me? How's she going to? And then, you know, I'm still young at the time, but also I knew he wasn't nice. He wasn't nice to us, right? Like when I had dreamed of having a father, like I don't even know the difference between stepfather and real father. I mean, I had never had either. So I'm thinking he's going to treat us all really good. And that didn't happen. So it became a lot of animosity, a lot of emotional baggage, you know? But, you know, I survived it enough to get to 17 years old, to get to college. And I was like, as soon as I can move in the dorms, I'm out of here. And I moved in. We were there waiting for them to open the building because I was like, I'm out. And it was a good transition. It was a good time and a good transition.
Did your mom encourage you to get good grades or did she not have time really to focus?
Yeah, it's an amazing story. I was just thinking about that this morning. My mom actually never told me I had to go to college. I remember watching the Brady Bunch one day, and it was an episode where Greg, he was like, I'm going to go join a band when I finish high school. And his parents were like, no, you're going to college. He was like, I don't want to go to college. And I remember after that episode, I went in my mom's room, and I'm like, you know, I think I'm mad at you. And she was like, what's going on? I'm like, why didn't you ever tell me I have to go to college? And she was like, are you going to go to college? And I was like, yeah. And she was like, well, I guess I didn't have to tell you. Like, so I'm not really sure what kind of like ninja magic she pulled on my life to be like, you are going to go. But I think it was like something in it was happening and she had never told me. And it was also like, I didn't have the pressure of like, you have to be a doctor. Or my mom was a teacher. Like, my mom, she never told me I had to be a teacher. I mean, I think she was pretty hands-off.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to KZFR 90.1 FM, Ask Dr. Gale Show. We're listening to Ashanti Branch, who's an educator, runs groups for boys of color in the Bay Area. Really warm, wonderful guy.
Hey, I need you to finish this thing. You know, I remember having arguments with her about finishing paperwork that, you know, if I was applying for a program or would I apply for Upward Bound. Upward Bound is a program that helps first-generation students go to college. You know? And I think I was around 14, maybe, at the time. So I asked her to fill this application out, and I turned it in the next day because I'm going to go to college, right? So I'm on focus. And then the lady was like, Ashanti, you know, I really want you to be in this program. I'm like, yeah, I'm going to college. Let's go. Like, sign me up. She was like, but we have a problem. Your mom said that she is a teacher. I'm like, yeah. What does that mean? He said, well, this program is for first-generation students. I said, well, hey, we're poor. I got to be first-generation. And they're like, no, if your mom's a teacher, she had to go to college. It was the first time I knew that my mom went to college, first of all. It was the first time that I realized that, you mean, my mom chose a profession and we're going to be this poor? Like, what's wrong with her? Like, so I knew two things that day, that I was going to never be a teacher. Like, I knew that, okay, if teachers make this little money, okay, I ain't ever going to be a teacher. And I was really kind of disappointed that my mom had chosen a profession that we make, you know, that we're making so little money that I got holes in my shoes. And when it rains, my feet are soaking wet, you know, that jack, you know. So I remember just feeling like confused by that fact. And I was like, why would anybody choose a job like that? Why would they choose a job? Her and my stepfather were always arguing about money and about stuff. And I'm like, Who wants a lifestyle like that? So I was like, I'm never going to be a teacher because I want a lifestyle that's amazing. I want to be rich. You know what I mean? And that's the journey of like realizing. So she never talked to me about college. She never asked me, you know, when I decided I was going to Cal Poly, she's like, okay. When I decided I was going to be an engineer, she's like, okay. It was never pretty hands off.
Young men that I've interviewed for the book in their early 20s, even them say when they were maybe middle school or earlier, they started hearing what it is to be a man. You're not like a girl. And you have a short video about that. You're not like a girl. You're not a sissy. You're not queer. You're not this. You're not that. I wonder what you heard and what you picked up. And was it from peers, relatives, media? What did you understand it means to be a man?
Yeah, great question. You know, my uncle told me I was supposed to be the man of the house at 7 years old. So I already thought I was a man. Like, I had been given the responsibility of taking care of my sibling. You know, I didn't make any kids. I didn't even know what that meant yet, but I knew I was the man of the house. So I thought that being a man was be responsible, take care of people around you. You have a lot of duties and chores and responsibilities. No one really cares about what you think or what you feel, but now this is in the house, right? Because I had a lot of responsibilities. Now, when I lived out of the house, the rules changed. So when I lived out of my mom's house, being a man was being tough, being strong, being dominant, having all the answers, like being too smart, wasn't it? But you like answers in the classroom actually is not really where your points were. It was on the playground. People were talking about sports or talking about the last wrestling match. Knowing all the facts and data and having this all the knowledge was what was seen as important. No one cared about if you knew the facts of any history or whatever. It's just about stuff that kids thought were important. The cool guys knew all the answers, right?
About
I think it was
sports.
Also like, well, about sports, about, you know, we talked a lot about wrestling mostly. I didn't know much about sports because no one was watching sports with me. We watched wrestling a lot. So it was a lot of dominance, like how tough you are. Like nobody backs down. Don't let anybody take advantage of you. And if you, I mean, I think, you know, my experience with trying to like prove the coolness was in early fourth grade, you know, around 8 years old. And I think that, you know, I also, you know, when I was 8 years old, I mean, so this is a this is probably not part of this conversation, but I was sexually assaulted at 8 years old, and it was a really rough experience in the sense that I couldn't talk about it because if I'm the man of the house, how are you the man of the house if you let this happen to you, right? How are you a man at all if you let somebody take advantage of you? So basically, I just kept it to myself. Yeah. You know, it happened in the dark of night at a camp, and I just thought I can never tell anybody, right? And I kept it. You know, it actually disappeared from my memories until I started doing this emotional work with other men and learning from other men about what had happened to them. And I'm like, oh wow, that was. Oh my goodness! Right, and I remember the moment that I recapped, and I think that I always was questioning, like, are you man enough? Right, at 7 years old to be the man of the house and be like, well, what does that mean? Like, I don't have no money, I have no job, I have a whole lot of responsibilities. I was a very domesticated man of the house. You know what I'm saying? Like, I knew how to take care of a home. You know what I'm saying? I can prepare any meal that needed to be prepared. Like, I was domesticated because that's what was needed. Mom was working. My job was to take care of the home. So it was really interesting how the role was always like, are you man enough? And I think I've had to be asked that question of myself a lot. Like, and I think that the question is always asked when you get older and you start having, when you get to high school. Now, let's say middle school became the time where boys in my circle started talking a lot about sex and talking about, you know, like I think I tell people I learned more sex ed in the back of algebra class than I did in any other class about sex, right? Because in the back of the algebra class, Calvin, who was like the biggest of the all middle schoolers, he always had a story about every Monday morning. Every Monday morning, Calvin had a story about what he did over the weekend. And so, you know, I'm good at math, so I finished my math really fast. And I'm all ears, right? I'm listening to all the stories. And I remember, like, when, like, I didn't interject because I don't know nothing. And then I remember the first day somebody was like, man, I was, like, you know, entertained by this conversation. I remember one of the boys in the circle was like, Chauncey, you don't know nothing about this. And I remember that first day I lied, right? Like, you're talking about, of course I do. And I remember, like, just like it was nothing. Like it was like, I mean, it wasn't an option. I mean, it was always an option, right? I always have a choice. But in that moment, it didn't feel like a choice. It felt like, uh-oh. So then people started, like, putting the attention on me. Now, I was not a person telling any stories. But at that moment, I began to now have to defend my manhood, my masculinity in front of these other middle school boys, young men who were, like, now saying, you're not a man. You ain't never seen this or done that or touched this or touched that. And I'm like, and I'm trying to, like, I'm spinning because I'm not at an age where I'm interested in it at all.
These guys are like 13.
Well, we're all in eighth and ninth grade. I think
13 and 14.
Yeah, 13 and 14. Yeah, because back then middle school was ninth grade still. Yeah. So, at least in California where I was, so it was ninth grade. I was in middle school. And I remember the feeling, the threat. Like the threat on my masculinity, right? And I remember feeling like, what? So I basically, like, I lied that one day. I remember lying. And then I didn't want to be in those conversations anymore. Because I knew that what I was having to do then is to prove something that, first of all, where was I learning it from? I was learning it from other teenagers, right? There was no man in my house teaching me any of this stuff, right? So I'm learning from the people who had learned from other teenagers, and everyone's learning some, you know, unhealthy stuff, you know, and sometimes even inappropriate stuff, right? So I think that's where it all kind of happened, you know, in that journey of trying to figure out, who are you? Are you man enough? And then constantly all over, you know, in the world just growing up, you're always in that space of, like, I mean, I went to college, and I mean, I didn't have. I think the first time I had sex, I was 18 years old. I was a second year. It was my second year in college. I was a sophomore, and I was like, "Whoa, right now, like it was a, it was a, it was like a wild experience, but it was always like, I still didn't tell anybody because it wasn't like I was, I felt ashamed that it was so late, right? Because everybody who I knew in most of my circles had started way before. So I felt like I was not only a late bloomer, but I felt like, I'm just going to like pretend like I've just been doing it all my life, right? So, you know, that's,
You know, there's a new book by Peggy Ornstein about boys and sexuality, and she says the same thing. Parents don't talk hardly at all to boys about sex, so they learn from peers and now from porn.
Yeah.
Which is really sad.
Really sad.
So when you went to Cal Poly, did you afterwards, I know you ended up as a math teacher, but before that, did you work as a civil engineer?
Oh, yeah. So I worked for about 5 years. Worked in a lot of design, building, a lot of construction type of work. I wanted to build things. I wanted to see things being built. I wasn't really into sitting in a cubicle designing. So I went into more of that work, and it was beautiful. Worked on a bunch of projects around the Bay Area, and then teaching called me. I mean, it was almost like it called me, and I ran from it. The first time it called, I was like, "Oh no!"
What someone said you should be a teacher, or what was the call?
Well, the first time somebody said I should be a teacher is when I was in college, but that was I felt insulted because I'm like, how dare you insult me as an engineering student here at Cal Poly and you tell me I should be a teacher? Teachers don't make money. I'm going to be rich, you know. That was the first time, and I remember feeling that insult. And then when I started tutoring at this learning center, and I remember just the two experiences in the learning center. One, I was at Upward Bound. I was tutoring at Upward Bound, the program I'm trying to get into. No, I was tutoring at Mills College in Oakland.
Oh, okay. This is after you graduated.
Yeah, after I graduated. So that the first calling was this person at school saying, like, I was taking a nap. I was taking a nap in the multicultural center. Someone said, "Oh, there's a group of high school students. They need a tour. Anybody help willing to do a tour?" I remember just like, "I'll do it," right? Like, it was like, they're like, and that's what that person said. "Sean, you always doing tours. You should be a teacher," like, right? And that's when I was like, "What?" And that's when I remember that moment. But graduate in engineering, you know, in the Bay Area, making money, and a buddy of mine asked me to tutor at Upward Bound, and I'm like, when? Saturday mornings? I don't even wake up Saturday mornings. I don't even know what Saturday morning looks like. You know what I'm saying? Because I thought that I was going to, like, learn about, like fun. I thought as an engineer I would be, like, happy ever after. Once you make good money, I thought you would just like it, just be happy all the time. And then I realized, wait a minute, something's missing here. Like, why don't I experience happy ever after? Because I was only looking for happy hour, you know? I was journeying for every happy hour I could find in the Bay Area. I experienced them. Because that's when happy started, around Friday around 5 p.m. And then Sunday around 7 p.m., happy started to fade away. And I was confused about that kind of journey. And then he said, "Look, I need you to tutor math. You're an engineer. You can do it." And I'm like, "Well, look, it's not that I can't do the math. I don't wake up Saturday mornings. I need my Friday night fun because it's the only time I'm really, like, enjoying life is Friday happy hour, you know?" And he said, "Well, look, give me 2 months so I can find a new teacher, and then, you know, I need somebody right now." And I said, "Okay, fine. You got 2 months." And I remember that first week, like, just feeling the calling. Like, here's how the calling happened. A kid named Damon, I'll never forget him, he walked in late. He started saying hello to everybody like he was Norm from Cheers. I'm like, "Dude, why are you saying hello to everybody? Like, what are you doing? Go sit down." And everybody wanted to say hi to him. He's like the mayor of this class. And I'm like, and I told him to come here. I said, "Listen, don't walk in my class a half hour late and then start talking to everybody." Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, I don't know what happened there before I got there, but I was clear about my standards. And I remember him, like, going back to the back, goofing off, and I made him sit next to me in the front. I was like, "Oh, no, you." So, and then I'll go drive home thinking, "I can't wait till next week. I can't wait." How I'm plotting for that kid. Like, I'm plotting what I'm going to say, do, how I was going to, like, interrupt his whole show. I'm like, "Shanti, why are you worried about this kid? Like, you're only here for 2 months." And it was like this thing that started kicking in, you know, this call. That was the first call. Second call, I'm tutoring at this place called the Huntington Learning Center. Huntington Learning Center was a space where students would get extra help on their support and whatever. And it's in a city where there's not a lot of living out black people. But definitely at this tutoring center, there's no other black mentors or teachers. So I'm an engineer. I find this job on accident because I was always leaving my office. My office is upstairs. I always leave the office and see kids in the lobby. I'm like, why are there kids here? Like, so one day at lunch, I went by there. They were like, oh, you're looking for a job? I'm like, job? I'm an engineer. I don't need no job. They're like, oh, we'll pay you $18 an hour to tutor math. I'm like, shoot, sign me up. I know good math any day. And I'm like, well, I can use that for traveling money. All I did when I left home from work anyway was to go home and play video games. I didn't do anything in the evenings. I was like, my life was kind of empty. So I was just working all day and then go home and do nothing. I'm like, okay, sign me up. So Lucas comes in one day. Lucas is having a test. My sign tells me all the students I'm working with individually. And it says, Lucas has an algebra test, blah, blah, blah. So I come around the corner and there's like two kids. I'm like, Lucas. And he looks up. He looks at me. Now, first of all, there's no black math teachers there, the tutors at all, and definitely not math. So he looks at me, and I look at him, and I'm like, are you Lucas? He's like, yeah. And I'm like, all right, come on, let's go. And we started getting, he said to me something like, you know I have a test, yeah? it was so cute. He was like, I think he was confused that how is this big dude with dreadlocks going to help him with his algebra test? He was stressing out. I'm like, dude, I got you. And I remember, like, helping him with a problem, multiplying polynomials. That was the problem. I'll never forget it. And I said, can you use shortcuts? And he's like, shortcuts? I'm like, yeah, can I? Can you? Will your teacher let you use shortcuts? He's like, I don't want to get the answer. I was like, all right, let me show you a shortcut, right? Because he didn't know what he's doing. Showed him the multiplying problem. He's like, what? That's it? I'm like, I don't know. You can make it harder if you want. So he tried one himself. I remember him trying it. And literally, this is what happened. The moment it happened, he looks at me, he says, is that the right answer? I'm like, oh, I don't know. Check the back of the book. You know, I knew the answer was right, but I want him to stress a little more. So I let him flip to the back of the book. And then he's looking. And then as he looks at the problem with his shortcut and his answer that was right, it was almost like in the back of his algebra book, I just saw like a rainbow and like flowers. And like I heard a sound. I heard a humming sound that was like, yes, this is what you're supposed to. It was almost like the call was like as powerful as it could be. It was almost like I could see the movie, like, you know, him opening the book and the answer popping out, like, yes. And that's what happened.
That's beautiful. That is so beautiful.
It was also scary. It was also scary because I'm like, wait a minute, this is like teaching. Teachers don't make money. And I remember feeling the stress of that call again. And so the next day I quit. The next day I quit that job. I was like, oh no, you're not sucking me into this low paid profession. Like, there's no way. So, and I really liked that job too, but I knew what was happening internally was a fight between who I believed I was supposed to be and who this calling was going to make me to be, you know.
So then what was the step that actually got you teaching in the classroom, teaching that?
Okay, I'm going to make it, long story shorter. let's see what happens. So I changed jobs because I can't see these people every day anymore because they're working upstairs, right? So I'm like, I got to change jobs. I go to a new job making more money in engineering in San Jose. I mean, I had to drive from my house an hour and a half every morning and every evening. So 3 hours a day commuting. I never knew why people would do that. I was like, that's so dumb. Who wants to drive that far every morning? Well, I know I did it because the money was there. And I was like, I don't want to move my whole house there. So I just did it. And I remember feeling like, wow, this is wild, right? So go to this new job, San Jose, Santana Road, one of the biggest projects that had ever been built in San Jose. $700 million project. I felt good. I was on a part of a big project. I go take a vacation, you know, engineering, you got vacation time. I go to Mexico. While I'm in Mexico, I see on the news that my building had caught on fire.
Whoa.
And I'm like, I'm looking at this thing, it says San Jose, but there's plenty, you know, there's San Jose, Costa Rica, and there's San Jose, other places. I'm like, San Jose, but this is California. Sounds like California. Because it was the floor plan of this building is like 1 acre. So it was the biggest building, like, that you probably have ever seen. Like, it was a huge building, mixed use, resident. You know, all that to say, my building caught on fire. Now, I didn't have to leave the job. That's more job security, right? Because now you got to fix the fire problem. But it made the job even more worse. It was like, no, I don't want this stress. This stress that the calling was already happening. And at that time, a buddy of mine invited me to apply to this program at Mills College. And when I got accepted to the program, I was like, yep, this is about to happen. And it was the moment, you know?
Was the program to get your credential?
The credential and the master's in education.
So, hello again. You're listening to KZFR 90.1 FM. This is Gail Kimball, Ask Dr. Gail Show. We're on the second Thursday of each month from 6 to 7. I would love to hear from you. My email is gkimball@csuchico.edu. Let me know what kind of interviews you'd like to hear, topics you'd like have me research. And remember, everything is on my YouTube channel if you want to have visual plus audio, including Ashanti Branch, who we're speaking with now.
I always see that I would finish my work like super quick. Like, I got it. Like, I love math. And it was, but every other class, like, I didn't really care about. So it wasn't until I got my act together my ninth grade year that it all turned around. And there was a teacher, my English teacher, actually, whose class I didn't like. She's the one who changed my life. You know, she said, I was in detention, and I didn't like her class, but I liked her. Like, I really liked her, Miss BP. And she was like, look, why are you acting like you're not smart? Tell me what this is about. Like, you're always goofing off, playing around. And I remember she said, I know your father died before you were born, but you're using that as an excuse. She said, life doesn't give us what we want. Life gives us what we get. We got to make the most out of it. And I remember that since I remember it, like it was yesterday, but it changed my life. It was like, I had been using my father's death as a thing that why I should be angry and sad. And sad wasn't accepted. You couldn't be sad in my community. You could be angry. So anything that could be seen as sad, you turned into anger. So I considered myself being very angry about my father's death because I didn't have anyone who even cared about your sadness. And that's how it all happened. That's how it all changed.
Wow.
And she changed my life, yeah.
You said that when you were teaching, you realized the kids weren't doing well, like boys of color, not because they couldn't do it, but because of the barriers. And you've talked about one of the barriers is it's not cool to be smart. It's like you're a wimp or something. But how did you reach out to your students? What grades did you teach when you started?
I was teaching ninth grade math, so I was an algebra teacher.
Uh huh. And yeah. So how did you get them out of that mindset that it's not cool to be smart and do well in school?
You know, I just actually made the connection right now that when I was getting my act together, this was the grade that I was teaching.
Yeah.
I just made the connection.
Yeah.
But I think what I knew was that when I was acting like I wasn't smart, it wasn't because I didn't really want to be smart, but I had the pressure of people around me. So I had to act the way that I was supposed to act, right? And what I learned to do with those young men was first say, well, I can't do it in the classroom. Because in the classroom, I'm going to point you out in front of everybody. I don't know who you're trying to impress necessarily. So when I started the Ever Forward Club, it was because I wanted to bring them to a space where they could be like, look, in this room, being your best self is the best way to be. Being all of you, like the best part of you is okay. It's actually not only expected, it's going to be inspected, and it's going to be accepted. And it was almost this idea that, like, I want you to be your best self. I want you to be like a rooster, like crowing and sharing how amazing you are. You know what I'm saying? Like, this is not a place to play small. And I think that what I tried to create for them, what I learned from them was that, well, if they're too afraid to do it in class, then I got to make a space for it. Yeah. And if society, until society is ready for our boys to be able to be fully emotional, fully be a full emotional being, meaning every emotion that exists in the human experience, you should be able to experience and have the permission to experience, and that you don't feel like less than because you do. And that's how it began to grow. And when they began to find that it was not only talked about, but it was demonstrated that your full self here matters, then it all changed. And that's how it all happened. That's how it all grew.
You know what I think is really interesting in organizing in general is food gets people out. So you said to the boys, come on Thursday noon, I'll have food for you.
Yeah.
And we'll
talk. I said, I'll buy you lunch once a week. In exchange for lunch, I want you to teach me to be a better teacher. Like, what am I doing wrong? Because I knew the math. I love math. Not only did I love math, I was good at helping people break down math into really simple ways. So it wasn't that I didn't think I was teaching well. It was something was missing in the translation between me trying to teach them math and them learning math from me. And that's how it all started. So Ever Forward became this program where I was like, look, not only in my math class, but also in that. But those lunches were like, this is a safe space for you to be yourself and figure out who do you want to be? Who are you dreaming of being? What's in the way? How can we support you? And they began to really build community with each other. And it was beautiful. It's beautiful to watch some of those young men who were, 14, 13 at the time, who now are still friends, who are in their 30s, who are like, they're connected, a lot of them, in some different cohorts or whatever, but just that brotherhood they created is almost indescribable, but it's also really beautiful.
It is beautiful. So you gave them a safe space, and you gave them an emotional toolbox. So how do you do that if their whole surrounding is you got to be tough?
Yeah, because I know that that's true on the outside of our circles. Our circles are private, so it's a, it started off with a group of 8 to 10 young men, and it grew to a club of over 75 students really fast, like in the first 2 years. I didn't know what I was doing. Like, I had no idea. But in those circles, when we originally were all young men together, it was a brotherhood. And it was like, hey, in this space, don't lie. Like, I don't care what prowess you have to prove out there, what, midnight stories you telling people out there. But in this room, truth is sacred, right? And I think they began to recognize that no one was trying to make them be who they weren't. No one was questioning all of their authenticity, right? I think if you're in a space where everyone is always questioning you, which I remember very well, and they're always testing you, then you have to continue stepping up to the test if you feel in the need to. And a lot of them did. And a lot of them were just amazing young men who just had not found their way of being themselves. And we created that space that in here, in this space, and we don't tolerate us putting anybody down. Like, no one, like, that's just not okay. And if you don't show up to a meeting, we're going to come get you. We're going to come find you because you don't miss a meeting, right? It's almost like family, right? No one left Ever Forward. Because you can't leave a family. Once you commit to being a part of it, unless you come to the circle and say, hey, everybody, I don't want to be a part of this no more. And we had one young man who we were still in touch with today. He came to one meeting. He's like, Branch, I'm leaving Ever Forward. I'm like, what do you mean leaving? He's like, I'm going to go start another club with some other friends. It was like an engineering club or something like that. I'm like, all right, well, you should come to the meeting and tell everybody where you're going and why you're leaving. And it was like, so when they see you around campus, it's still respect. It's not like he disappeared, he left us, he's going to talk about our stuff with other people. You come to the space and you let the men know. And it was like a respect thing. And that's how we began to create it. And it's like, I treat them, I learned this kind of phrase later, but this is how it was. I treated them like they were 5 years older than they were. So they were 13, 14. I treated them like they were 19, 18, like they were pretty much young men. And I expected them to act like they were 5 years younger. Meaning, if you're 13, I'm expecting that a lot of times you're going to act like you're 8. So because I held them to a high expectation, and I expected them to be acting probably less than that, there was not of me like saying, act like an adult when you're not really an adult. You are your kid, and you're trying to figure out kid world. And even though you want to be treated like an adult, you may act like you're definitely not. And I think it was like helping them start to learn, hey, how do you want me to treat you right now? Because you're talking to me really disrespectfully. I'm not disrespecting you. And they're like, oh, they have them check it in with themselves. Like, I wasn't trying to be disrespectful. I didn't mean that. Or whatever it was. Like, well, I'm mad. I'm like, well, you have the right to be mad. You can be mad. I can't have you being mad, but does mad mean you have to disrespect me? Like, you know what I'm saying? So really helping them to learn how to communicate, but also giving them vocabulary and emotional language that they could navigate.
So this started in 2004, the club?
2004, yeah.
And did the girls say, oh, well, we want a forward club too?
Yeah, so the girls were upset with me because every Thursday at lunch, I would send them out of my room. People hung out in my room all the time. So Thursday at lunch, I would send all the, sorry, ladies, you gotta go. And so one girl, I'll never forget her, Tequila, she would always be like, this is the women haters club. I'm like, what are you talking about? She's like, how you going to kick us out every Thursday? I'm like, well, look, you want to buy you lunch, I'll buy you lunch next week. They're like, I don't want lunch. We want our own club. And I'm like, I can't run a club for girls. What do I know about that, right? So what we did the following year is we started a teacher who was willing to run that club, started the Young Women's Club. So we had the Ever Forward Club, and then we had Ever Forward. We called it Chicas, which was for young girls. And then we had Siempre Adelante, which was for the newcomers, because a lot of the newcomers to, you know, the U.S. were getting recruited by some of the gangs, and I was seeing really good kids getting sucked in. So I created a club for them. So we had three clubs at one point, because I was still learning Spanish, so I made sure that any student wanted to be a part of that. And that was co-ed because I couldn't have more than one at the time. But it was a space for them to know that they weren't going to get sucked into having to join a gang because they didn't speak the language and they needed what they thought was protection. So we created a club for them.
Right. So this was in all of this is in Oakland.
This is a city called San Lorenzo, which is like right outside of Oakland. So from north to south is Oakland and San Leandro, San Lorenzo. So it's like a little unincorporated town. A lot of kids from Oakland went there.
Okay. So what I think is amazing, you said that 93% of the kids who were in the club have gone on to college. And is that since 2004?
Yeah.
Through all those years?
Yeah.
That many kids going to college? Wow.
They go to college. 93% go to college, military, or trade school. So they all have a post-secondary plan. And, you know, some of them just go off and work and get a job. Or, you know, and some start on their own business. We have a couple of them that are entrepreneurs who start their own businesses. And, I think it was kind of like this idea that if you are in a space where high expectations are the norm, meaning regardless of what your I was always like, you know, hopefully you have a good family and a supportive family. I wasn't there to like replace a family. We were creating what's called an academic family, right? We are here at school. We're going to support you in your growth, and we need you to just give your best. And so what we did with them is we helped them build from there. Most times if you have a goal in life, it's going to take some kind of extra knowledge than high school. High school only give you enough to get a job somewhere at a widget factory, right? Where you can follow instructions, you can follow the bell, you can, you know, show up on time. Like, those are the main skills. I need some knowledge stuff too, but like to be job ready, you have to build some skills. So what kind of career, we started asking them the question, what do you want to do with your life? And most of them wanted to do something with their life. And so how are you going to get there? It was not me telling them they had to go to college. We took them on college tours so they could see colleges and begin to say, you know what, that's too big, that's too small, that's too this, that's too that. And it wasn't me saying, you must go. Here's what I told all the young people in Ever Forward. You all must be A through G ready, period. Now, whether you go or not, I don't care. I did care, you know what I'm saying? I really did want them to go to college, not for college sake, but because I knew how college had made my life so much more rich, right? I told them, look, you're going to all be A through G ready. So because most times the 13-year-olds in high school sabotage their same 18-year-old selves, right? Because by the time you get to be 17 or 18, you're more mature. And you're like, wait a minute, I can't go to college now? What happened? Well, because your first 2 years, you were here goofing off, acting like a little immature, you know, and now you're like, oh, but who are you going to be mad at but yourself? Because it's your own fault. It was you. It wasn't nobody else did it to you. And I think that what we help them see is that I don't care if you go to college or not, but you're going to be ready if you choose to go. And that's how it'll happen. So that for those who weren't mature enough yet, they had to do the work, the hard work, so that whether they went to a 2 year or a 4 year, they were ready for a big college. And I recommend they go to junior college. Some want to go to big colleges. And I said, you know what? Some want to go to small college. And I said, man, maybe you should think about going straight to the big college. Because they were ready, you know. So it was not me telling them to go anywhere, but just saying, what's next for you? What's your goals? And when you help them figure that out, I think they become amazed.
So the emotional toolkit that you taught them is just giving them the safe space and the vocabulary to say there are other emotions besides anger and pride in succeeding or something. So
yeah,
it's okay to talk about my girlfriend dumped me and I feel sad.
That's right. That's right. And I think the emotional toolkit was also this place of like, I told young people, most times I saw young people with two tools. They had a hammer and they had a tickler. And I'm like, okay, if you're not laughing about it, you're angry about it. Like, okay, well, there's a whole lot more emotions in the middle of those two. And I think really helping them navigate, well, what am I really feeling? Oh, am I angry? Okay, what are you angry about? Well, I'm angry because this thing happened. Okay, so what about that thing made you angry? Right? And you help them like learn how to navigate what they're feeling, because they don't have a way of navigating their feelings in a healthy way. They're gonna turn every emotion into an emotion that it's not, and they're not gonna get the solution they're looking for, right? So it's like, even if somebody goes up to them and says, well, what's wrong with you? Well, I'm mad. What are you mad about? Well, I'm mad because of this, you know, this girl didn't give me her phone number. Like, I remember many times of being angry because a girl wouldn't give me her number. Now, deep down, why am I mad at her? Like, I 5 minutes ago, I want the number, and now I hate her, and she's all kind of bad names. Well, that's why I learned that from other big guys, right? That's what you do. But technically, I had no way of dealing with feeling embarrassed. How do you deal with embarrassment? I felt embarrassed. Like, embarrassment is a part of the human nature, right? So you just feel it. You just say, man, it doesn't feel good. I feel ashamed. I feel like she didn't call me ugly. Does she think I'm ugly? Like, whatever I'm telling, the story I'm telling myself, where do I get clear about why I feel what I feel? But if I don't have anybody helping me navigate feelings, like, especially when students, you know, they have those young loves and they break up and now they want to be vindictive. I'm like, no. What are you doing? Why? Well, because it feels vindictive, right? It feels like I'm going to get back. I'm hurt. So I want that person to hurt. Well, why? And I think that we help them start learning about why. Where did you see that happen before in your life? What made you think that that's a good thing to do? Because you're now hurt, right? And no matter what, no matter how it happened, no matter you got dumped, you dumped. Oh, so you dumped that person, and it's okay, but they dumped you, and now you're going to be. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, how do you help them navigate how they show up in the world? Because sometimes those behaviors are learned, but sometimes they are created by a message that we've been telling ourselves.
For sure. Is there a way that people who want to duplicate the program, is there like a written curriculum or a model so it's easy for people to duplicate?
Yeah, we created a program so people can bring it into their schools, and that's how we as an organization have grown. And then we also created just recently a box, which is called Taking Off the Mask, the box. And people can run the workshops at their school as well. So if they want to run a club, we can train them to run a club. So, and now we created another tool that's a lot less expensive to run, that they can order this kit. I'll show you the links and everything so you can share that. But I think the kit is a way for people to like do our signature workshop in their schools and us not need to be there, because some schools don't have the resources to bring us in, you know?
Right. And then you left teaching to do the Forward Club full time?
Yeah, Ever Forward. Yeah, 2016, after I left the fellowship at Stanford, I came on full time as the ED. I had 3 months of revenue to navigate. I had enough for 3 months of survival. And there was myself, a program officer, and we had a COO at the time. And we just started moving. And we started moving. And literally it's been, 5 years ago? Yeah, October my anniversary. This will be my fifth year, 2016, my fifth year anniversary. Yeah, I think it's time for a sabbatical. I think it's time.
At this point, do you have kids?
I don't. Yeah, no. I think about that a lot. I raised, my siblings, and then while I was teaching in this work, I raised two godsons, actually three. It's a question I think about a lot. I think about legacy. I think about, at the end of, after me, right, on this family tree, at this current present moment, it just stops. And so sometimes I feel really sad about that. I grew up raising kids. I just don't have the energy to raise kids. I want kids, but it's not fair to want them and not be willing to do all the work it takes to raise them, And so I have a battle. I mean, I have a really existential battle, wanting the legacy of my life to have to continue on this leg of my family tree, and also knowing that it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work. I don't get excited when I think about babies. I like babies, but you know how much work that is?
I do. You don't sleep for a year.
Yeah, now I have a new puppy. It's the same thing as having a baby. So as you know, you're listening to KZFR 90.1 FM. We appreciate your support and continue listening. Tune in 2 weeks from today for the next Ask Dr. Gale show. And now stay tuned for peanut butter and jelly time. Yay!